This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, you can listen to The Takeaway anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can find that on our website, thetakeaway.org, or on iTunes. The hottest Jackson ticket. The memorial service for Michael Jackson is expected to draw huge crowds to downtown Los Angeles, and additional crowds will line the route of a motorcade for the body of the pop singer and his family. Streets will close at 6 a.m. West Coast time around the Staples Center, where the memorial concert will begin mid-morning. Being there for Michael on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. You know, folks, from Moscow, where Barack Obama has been speaking to the Russian people, to Los Angeles, where the world is waiting to say goodbye to Michael Jackson, one can make a pretty good case this morning that African Americans occupy a very lofty place in global culture. I'm here with co-host Todd Zwillick. Hello, Todd.
Good morning, John. Also on the program, Social Security and Global Hackers. There's an update on the U.S. offensive in Afghanistan, and the supporters of Sarah Palin speak out on what they think of her resignation. Those stories will be coming up, but first we have the headlines.
And in the headlines, on the second day of his visit to Moscow, President Obama urged the Russian people to join the United States in burying the mistrusts of the Cold War. Speaking to economics graduates, he said the days of big power politics, when countries could be treated as chess pieces, are now over. The world bids a final farewell to Michael Jackson today in Los Angeles. His family will hold a private funeral in L.A. before the public memorial at the city's Staples Center. Police are warning ticket holders not to try to sell their tickets. They will arrest scalpers. And joining us from outside the Staples Center is L.A. resident and The Takeaway's reporter on the scene, Josh Rogerson. Josh, good morning.
Good morning.
You've got a fan with you right now?
Yeah, van traveled all the way here from London.
And Van, what do you say goodbye to today? What does Michael Jackson mean to you?
I came in all the way from London. I wasn't going to miss it. By the third day, I had to go. I looked my boss in the eye and said, look, I'm going. And nothing could do. I'm here. It's going to be electric, magnificent, magical.
And do you have a ticket to get inside the Staples Center?
I'm sorry. He just handed back the phone to me, John.
Is he wearing one of those wrists, Josh? Those wristbands?
He's not wearing one of the gold wristbands, which is the only way to get into the Staples Center is if you have a wristband accompanied with a ticket or if you're an elephant arriving for the circus.
All right. More about those details and some of the chaos that's developing there around the Staples Center as we go this morning. Thank you, Josh. Turning to other headlines for just a moment, Al Franken will be sworn in as Minnesota's junior senator today. He's joining the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is scheduled to begin hearings next week on Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor. Todd?
Going abroad. Briefly, the Iraqi government has banned all organized visits by school children to the grave of the country's former leader, Saddam Hussein. The order was given after some Iraqi schools took pupils to visit the site in the north of Baghdad, John.
And the Dow opens today at 83.25. It's expected to be a flat opening. The Nasdaq starts trading at 17.87. The king of pop, the world will say goodbye to the king of pop today, but we're asking you, who's the best live performer you ever saw in your life? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Michael Jackson could be the answer to that.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick. I'm here with John Hockenberry. Let's go to Russia now. President Obama spoke in Moscow early this morning. He spoke to graduates of the new economic school in a speech also meant to reach the whole nation of Russia, not to mention an audience in Europe and the United States. Well, earlier today, the president also had breakfast talks with Prime Minister Vladimir Putin at Putin's country home outside Moscow. They call that the country?
Dacha.
The Dacha. Thank you. I was going to call it the Duma. I knew that wasn't right. He was calling him president for a while, actually, but he is the prime minister. I think our president was a little confused about that for a while. Well, joining us to recap the speech and tell us what he heard, Clifford Levy with the New York Times. He's Moscow bureau chief, and he was on hand for the speech. Clifford, mutual respect between the United States and Russia or mutual rivalry? Which tack is the president taking here?
I think he's definitely taking the tack of mutual respect. He used the speech to emphasize a lot of the themes that have been the basis for his trip, that the United States wants to work with Russia on issues like nuclear proliferation and terrorism, that Russia and the United States share common interests. And he also made clear that he had not come here to dictate to Russia how it should handle its affairs.
And how is the president being received in Russia? He got this rock star treatment on his first trip to Europe. He gets rock star treatment in so many places he goes around the world, but something a little more tepid in Russia?
I think it's a little calmer here. I would definitely say that he's not being received as a rock star. He's being received respectfully, but certainly not like the kind of celebrity coverage that we've seen in other places. Certainly nothing like, for example, what we saw in Germany last year.
All right, well, missile defense as a bulwark against Iranian development of nuclear weapons has been a major issue between the United States and Russia. It was started by George W. Bush, a program set in motion to have a missile defense basically on Russia's border. Is President Obama sticking to that plan, or is there wiggle room here from the point of view of the Russians on missile defense?
You know, it's a complicated issue, and it's obviously one of the most provocative issues in the Russian-American relationship now. This is a proposal that came out of the Bush administration that President Bush championed. It's clear that President Obama is not a strong proponent of it. However, President Obama has not said at this point that he's going to abandon it. All he has said is that he is going to study it. There was some sense that this issue could have actually led to a lot of tensions at the summit yesterday and today. However, it appears that both sides are trying to sort of delay having to address that. They've essentially said they're going to create a commission to jointly examine the threat from Iran, and they're going to continue discussing missile defense and also how it possibly links up with cuts in nuclear arsenals for each country's nuclear arsenal.
Well, Clifford, it did seem like the president was allowing for the possibility that that whole missile defense thing would be abandoned. But I'm wondering if even more broadly, the president is taking a really interesting tack here. I mean, this might be a moment, even with the global recession, for a bit of gloating at the profile of Obama versus the profile of Medvedev and Russia in general. Yet it seems like he was taking great pains in the speech to elevate the significance of Russia right now, to elevate its place in history at this moment.
Well, clearly you don't want to come to Russia as a guest and portray yourself as a kind of a world luminary. And especially Russia, which is highly, highly sensitive to these kind of issues of protocol and issues of history. This is a country that clearly mourns its loss of superpower status, and you don't want to rub it in their faces.
Well, Clifford, before we go, though, that being the case, the president, you don't want to rub it in their faces, but the president also went at the issue of independent media, free elections, freedom of assembly, seeming to go right at Vladimir Putin. Is Putin going to let those things happen in Russia?
Well, actually, I don't think he said it in a particularly provocative way. I think he tried to say it in a more nuanced way. You know, he is, for example, today he's attending a civil society forum, but he's not doing it in a way that's sort of, again, one of the major themes of his visit here, he says, is that he's not going to dictate to Russia how it should carry out its affairs.
President Obama on the diplomacy offensive in Russia. Clifford Levy, New York Times Moscow bureau chief, helping us understand the president's speech in front of Putin and Medvedev and all of Russia. Thanks, Clifford.
So Michael Jackson laid to rest this morning in Los Angeles in a private ceremony at Forest Lawn Cemetery in the Hollywood Hills. Funeral not open to Michael Jackson's fans, but 8,000 screaming, fainting, devoted fans are expected to fill stands at the Staples Center, with many thousands spilling over to the streets surrounding the arena. Whether you're a fan of his music or whether you believe that his life story is related to yours in some way, it's a complicated Michael Jackson narrative that is being put to rest today. and particularly complicated for African Americans. Stephen Gray, reporter for Time magazine in Chicago, wrote the piece Michael Jackson and the Black Experience for Time.com. Stephen joins us this morning. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. How are you?
It does seem that a lot of African American political leaders and pop stars are going out of their way to make some kind of a statement this morning by their presence or even absence from this event. What do you think that is?
Well, I think in many ways it reflects the great deal of respect that many Black Americans, like people around the world, have for Michael Jackson. I think it's largely due to just his extraordinary talent. I think that's primarily what's behind it.
It seemed that Michael Jackson began as a young pop star, along with the Jackson 5, Gary, Indiana, coming out of poverty, or certainly a place like Gary, which was at least obscure. Maybe Robert Preston made it famous in Music Man, but Michael Jackson's original story was very, very familiar. But then he transcended, first of all, music, and then race in a certain sense, and then very deliberately seemed to want to rewrite his own ethnicity in some way. And now it comes back to this very, very original story. Is that the experience of people like yourself experiencing Michael Jackson now in his passing?
No, I mean, I grew up listening to Michael Jackson's music in the 1980s. I mean, that's, I've been a fan since then. But I think in many ways, Michael Jackson does reflect so many aspects of the Black American experience here. But I think for starters, Michael's music was always fundamentally Black music. I mean, you could hear echoes of James Brown and other soul legends in his music, even as it ventured further into pop. I think that in terms of, obviously Michael underwent this extreme physical transformation from a fairly middle, medium brown skinned Black guy with an afro and puffy cheeks and a wide nose into something resembling a fairly gaunt white woman. And one of the tragedies of this whole experience of his passing is that, he will never be able to fully explain the truth behind that evolution. And it's certainly, I wouldn't call it ambivalence, but I think it certainly caused a bit of the conflicted feelings, certainly,
right,
that I think many African Americans feel toward Michael, because his physical transformation does sort of hit a number of chords. I mean,
sure,
the chord of this whole idea of Black masculinity, as well as our own collective unease in dealing with issues of gender identity.
Well, let's talk about that for just a second. I mean, Stephen Gray is the author of Michael Jackson and the Black Experience on Time.com. He's a reporter for Time magazine in Chicago. I mean, Michael Jackson's gestures and music and lifestyle really are the model for the entire bling hip-hop experience, it seems to me. Yet, there's also this anxiety and, as you say, ambivalence about masculinity.
Well, I wouldn't say ambivalence. I think it's just, I would say more precisely, it'd be more, conflicted feelings. But I think that, by and large, I think that people, at least people I hang out with and talk to, and it's obviously evident from just seeing people on TV and in the streets, people loved Michael, I think, primarily because he was simply an extraordinary talent. And in some cases, people were simply willing to overlook many of his eccentricities. So,
do you think his success proved to be a curse in a deeper personal, I don't get the sense that Michael Jackson was very happy for much of his life.
I never met Michael, and the tragedy is that he will never be able to fully explain what was really happening in his head.
He seemed so unconnected from any community, let alone the celebrity community that he was involved in.
I don't follow Hollywood on a regular basis, but to me, I can tell you just from listening to his music, I heard someone who was still fairly connected to his roots, someone who was still at its core very much a Black artist, someone who was very much a soul musician.
Of course, it's going to be covers at this ceremony today in Los Angeles. I'm assuming you're going to be watching it. What tune do you want to hear most?
I don't know. Maybe Don't Stop Till You Get Enough. I'm not sure. Maybe Beat It. I mean, those are some of my favorites from the 80s.
Yeah, well, you grew up with Michael Jackson in the Thriller era. I grew up with him in the Jackson 5 era through the 70s into the Thriller era and then way beyond. Stephen Gray, reporter for Time magazine in Chicago, wrote Michael Jackson and the Black Experience for Time.com, saying goodbye, as we all are, to Michael Jackson today. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry here with Todd Zwillick. Monster performances, monster live performances. That's a signature of Michael Jackson.
Yep.
And?
And who else?
Who's the greatest live performer in your life?
In my life? Well, God, we had Iggy Pop before. I got to go with Iggy. I have to say David Bowie.
David Bowie,
I mentioned Bill Clinton. He's up there as best live performer.
And somebody agreed with you?
Yep.
And we have other suggestions from our audience?
Hi, this is Randy from Fitchburg calling for the best live band that I've seen. That would be Dinosaur Jr. They've been around for a long time, and they're still getting louder.
Dinosaur Jr. Evan Dando, it's a 90s rock group. Can they take the King of Pop's place? Jay Maskus, I was just informed. Why I said Evan Dando, I'm not sure. It must have been another 90s band. John's shrugging his shoulders in utter disinterest. Tell us your thoughts.
Not disinterest, no.
Tell us your thoughts. 8778 my take at thetakeaway.org. Best live performer of all time. Best
Pittsburgh
live performer
Dinosaur
that might
Jr.
be able to.
Connection.
Dinosaur Jr. might be able to.
Pittsburgh, yeah. Huge thing.
Huge thing. Well, let's talk about health insurance. Not just health insurance, identities. Because from health insurance forms to your cell phone bills, our social security numbers, they go on everything these days. Listen to this.
Our main message is really that social security numbers are very bad passwords, and we should start moving towards something more secure and more private.
All right, well, that's Alessandro Esquedi, and he's a professor and an economist at Carnegie Mellon and author of a study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that says our social security numbers are not at all secure. They figure out an algorithm in this study that can figure out the first five digits of 44% of all social security numbers on the first try. It's horrifying. Here to tell us more about the study and how we might fix what is so wrong with the social security numbering system is Peter Swire. He's an Ohio State law professor, and he was chief privacy counselor in the Clinton administration. Professor Swire, it's even worse than what I just said. They said in 9% of cases, they could predict all nine numbers of people who were born after 1988. So if you're a good enough programmer, is it open season on our identities?
Well, it's a lot more open season than the agencies would like it to be or than most people are comfortable with.
Did you all worry about this in the Clinton administration?
Well, we've been worrying about Social Security numbers and their security for a long time. We were trying to pass a bill in the late 1990s trying to make sure that these Social Security numbers wouldn't be up on the Internet. There's a lot of public records, land records and things like that, where people's socials are public. And we worked with Congress to try to pass something, and it got close but didn't pass at that time.
All right. Well, I was under the impression that a Social Security number is either a random assortment of nine digits or they kind of go in order that you're born so that somebody, you know, born in the 70s like me would have a number similar to mine. Is that how they're generated?
It's a little different than that. I think what this study really highlights is the first five digits are based on geography and the period of time that you were assigned the number. The reason that things changed in the late 80s is the kids started to get socials when they were born. And so you'd know the place of date, so that would help you figure out where the numbers are. And then you'd have a really good guess at the date of when they got it, because they were getting it when they were born. And that combination meant that the socials are a lot easier to guess.
So without getting into the complexities of a computer algorithm, is there a relatively simple way to explain how a program would work that could crunch these numbers 1,000 times over like they did in this Carnegie Mellon study and come up with right answers 9% of the time? I mean,
yeah,
that's easy.
One of the things is it actually comes from an effort to stop fraud, which is there's something called the Master Death Index, which by itself is a pretty scary name for something. Yeah. But the Master Death Index lists the people who die in the United States, and it sends out to people like credit bureaus saying, don't use these Social Security numbers. These people are dead. And if anyone's trying to pretend to get a credit card with it, you can't use it. That means there's a public record of the socials of people who've died. And that now gives you a really good window into how the things are assigned, because you can figure out where they were born. You can figure out when they were born. And with that database, it became possible to reverse engineer how the Social Security Administration assigned a lot of these numbers.
And I would assume because a relatively low number of people who were born after 1988 have died because they're young, mm-hmm. it's a pretty small universe, a relatively small universe for a programmer.
But one of the things is it's not just after 1988. That's what the study featured.
Right.
But the techniques went on before that. And the broader story here is that Social Security numbers were invented way back in the 1930s. And as a security technology relying on the 9 digits, they're really getting pretty old and out of date. And it turns out there's a lot of different problems with Social Security numbers.
Well, doing away with them is obviously not an option.
Yeah,
we all have them.
I mean, there's got to be a fix here. You got 9-digit numbers, so that's a good start.
Well, so it's a good start for some things. The tech people will tell you it might be good as an identifier. You're going to be the only person whose file is going to have those 9 digits. It's become a very, very bad password. And so any system that says, hey, tell me your last 4 or your first 5, those kinds of systems are not systems we should be relying on going forward.
Well, the Social Security Administration, in some quotes that I saw, said they've been going around, you know, like you said, telling people don't use Social Security numbers on the Internet and don't use them as unique identifiers. But mm-hmm. everybody does it anyway. Why? Just because it's easier? It saves money?
It's easier than anything else. And no one has wanted to go through the process of coming up with a better way. And I just, you know, what I've been saying is this is a wake-up call. We have a known system that's leading to a lot of identity theft and will lead to a lot more identity theft. We probably have to suck it up as a society and get to a new system.
Can you negotiate with your service provider to say, look, don't use my Social Security number. I'll give you another unique number. I mean, will they be open to that? They don't really need the number if it's a bad password.
It depends on the place, but there's been a lot of people, you know, do that. They go to the hospital and say, no, I'm not going to give you the Social Security number. Doctor's offices, banks, credit bureaus resist that. And they've got their system in place. They don't want to spend to move to a new system. But as an individual, one of the things to do as an individual is to check your credit history and make sure no one's faking and using your Social Security number. So the news you can use thing here is go to annualcreditreport.com, which is the actual way to get free credit reports, and check your credit history a couple times a year. That's the best way to make sure no one's stealing your identity.
Okay, Professor Peter Swire, Ohio State University Law Professor, thanks for joining us. He was the chief privacy counselor in the Clinton administration in privacy. Boy, oh boy, a study from Carnegie Mellon says that our Social Security numbers, which we knew weren't safe, they're extraordinarily unsafe. All right, Mark. Headlines with Mark Garrison.
Thank you, Todd. 29 minutes after the hour, and Los Angeles authorities are warning Michael Jackson fans without entry wristbands to the memorial service at the Staples Center to stay away. They say scalpers will not be tolerated. Also today, Al Franken will be sworn in as Minnesota's junior senator. He will be sworn in on a Bible from the family of the late Paul Wellstone, the senator also from Minnesota. China has a curfew in place in its northwestern provinces that follows deadly ethnic violence there. And in Iraq, the government has banned all organized visits by students to the grave of former leader Saddam Hussein. It's still open to the public, just not for field trips. That's the news. John and Todd.
Thank you. And we are following the memorial service that happens in about 4 hours from now in Los Angeles. Thank you, Mark.
You bet.
The The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
So we began the hour this morning talking about Barack Obama's trip to Moscow. He spoke with a group of economic students at their commencement, and we took a look at what that means and the tone between the U.S. and Russia, but a slightly different look now. Joining us is Susan Eisenhower, president of the Eisenhower Group. She serves as chairman of the Eisenhower Institute's leadership and public policy programs, and she's also a granddaughter of President Dwight D. Eisenhower. Susan, thanks for joining us.
Well, good morning. How are you?
This seems to be a really heady moment. Barack Obama delivering economics lessons to economic students in Moscow sounds almost like an oxymoron, but in fact, it was a very persuasive moment. There's plenty to talk about economically these days between the U.S. and Russia.
Well, this particular school that he's addressed is a very progressive institution that, supports many of the economic objectives we've had towards Russia since the outset. And I think it was an important talk. There's been sort of a tradition for presidents to go to Moscow and speak to a group of students somewhere. So it was rather significant that this particular school was chosen.
There's no Cold War rivalry anymore, although Barack Obama did step through the history of the Cold War era in his speech. What would you call this relationship? It's not a rivalry necessarily, but there is a certain amount of competition. How would you characterize it?
Well, I think competition is an excellent word. And since the collapse of the Soviet Union almost 20 years ago, Russia's been trying to get back up on its feet and to be, taken seriously as a world power. I don't think we could expect them to have any different attitude. They've always been a major power in Europe and then eventually internationally after World War II. And so they want to reestablish some kind of a position. And I think the summit, has set, a very constructive tone, actually.
In preparing for today, it reminded me of the moments in the last months of your grandfather's presidency when Nikita Khrushchev and then Vice President Richard Nixon had the famous kitchen debate. Here's an excerpt of what amounted to a kind of impromptu, let's talk to each other, let's cooperate sort of conversation here. Listen.
That's what we're telling you. Don't be afraid of ideas. We have nothing to fear. The time has passed when ideas scare us.
Well, then let's have more exchange of them. We all agree on that, right?
Agreeing with what? Of course I agree, but I want to clarify what I agree with.
And, of course, later on in that conversation, Khrushchev reportedly said that the Soviet system would bury the capitalist system eventually. What do you make of that kind of forced, chuckling, let's cooperate more tone with what we have today?
Well, it's there is a lot of attention to the 50th anniversary of not only that debate, but also Khrushchev's 2 weeks visit to the United States during the Eisenhower administration. But I have to really say, I've been traveling to Russia for 25 years, Soviet Union and then Russia, and it's really important to emphasize that this period is wholly different than the Cold War. We have no ideological differences with Russia per se. We obviously have disagreements about internal developments in that country, but certainly there's no broad ideological divide that could create an automatic confrontation. We have considerably more business contact today than we did before, and we do have, as we've seen in the last day or so, constructive dialogue on the potential for cooperation on other international issues. I think it's also important to note that President Obama is not only a youthful presidential figure, but Dmitry Medvedev, I think, is 44 years old.
Right.
Vladimir Putin's maybe 54. We have a completely new generation of leaders looking at really contemporary issues.
No, you're right. The Cold War references were all about the Cold War being over. But if you listen really carefully to Obama's speech, there is a reference in there way down to a statement that your grandfather made about the dangers of the military-industrial complex, of militaries determining world affairs. Here's Obama speaking in a reference that I think goes right back to those original lines of your grandfather.
You get to decide what comes next. You get to choose where change will take us. Because the future does not belong to those who gather armies on a field of battle or bury missiles in the ground. The future belongs to young people with an education and the imagination to create. That is the source of power in this century.
Imagination and education as an antidote to the sort of military competition of the past. I think that relates directly to what your grandfather was warning us all about.
Well, yes. I mean, actually, I think those are very stirring words, and I have to tell you, I think they'll be very resonant in Russia today because we have a new generation that is in power there, despite the differences we've had with that country, and despite the awkward state of the relationship here for the last. About 5 years, really. The truth of the matter is there is a group of people who are in power today who only dimly remember the Cold War and even the Soviet Union. That was 20 years ago, so that means even the president of Russia was probably just in college when the Soviet Union collapsed.
And
Obama's correct to see this as a huge opportunity.
And even during that time, you know, the term soft power gets thrown around so much, but one of our greatest powers with the old Soviet Union was their fascination with our popular culture and our consumer culture. We used to hear when we were kids about how much Russians wanted Levi's blue jeans. Does any of that fascination still exist, or has the internet and global media opened things up so much that we don't have as much fascination for Russians anymore?
Well, I think that there is an enormous opportunity here to continue to build on cultural touchstones. If you go to downtown Moscow, for instance, you'd be hard-pressed to think of this as the Russian capital because so much of it reminds you of being in other parts of Europe where Gap is on one corner and Banana Republic's on another corner.
Oh, geez,
I mean, we have enormous commercial touchstones now today. But we do have, you know, an opportunity for building much more on an agenda around the future.
Well, it's a very interesting legacy, and the potential is certainly there in the speech. And, of course, there are obstacles. We didn't really talk about those. There are obstacles as we look at this Russian government. But, Susan Eisenhower, thank you so much for being with us. Granddaughter of President Eisenhower, Russian expert, and chairwoman of the Eisenhower's Institute of Leadership and Public Policy. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
Prokofiev here on The Takeaway with Mark Garrison in the headlines.
Well chosen. It's 20 minutes before the hour. Michael Jackson's memorial service is on later today. It's just after 5:30 a.m. in L.A. right now, but fans are already showing up for the service coming later. Police want those without tickets to the Staples Center to stay away and watch from home. The Jackson family has a private funeral at a ceremony ahead of the big public memorial. The Pakistani army says a suspected U.S. drone attack on a Taliban training camp today is getting in the way of Pakistan's own campaign against militants. Pakistani officials have long argued that U.S. drone attacks alienate locals, and the South Carolina Republican Party has censured Governor Mark Sanford after his trip to Argentina last month. John and Todd.
Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Ethnic tension in northwest China. That's the sound this morning of thousands of ethnic Han Chinese carrying clubs, machetes, and homemade weapons marching today through Changjing province in response to riots by local Uyghurs. It's a continuation of tense ethnic protests in that northwest region of China. And those clashes between Han Chinese and Muslim Uyghurs have left over 150 dead. Joining us now is the China editor for the BBC, Xiong Chen. He's in London this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
And what do we know? It's very difficult to report from this particular zone in China. What do we know is going on right now?
Well, what had happened after the Sunday riots with, as you say, 156 people dead and about 1,000 people injured, the tension there is getting almost out of control. You have heard the Han Chinese going on the street, but that's a kind of, I think, a deliberate attempt by the authorities to release a kind of pressure valve for the Han Chinese, and presumably a large part of the dead and injured are the Han Chinese there in the capital city. And so the from the grassroots level, the Han Chinese and the indigenous Uyghurs didn't see eye to eye to each other, and after the what happened on Sunday, they feel they have been suppressed as well. So apart from that, the situation in the whole region is really still tense, with thousands and thousands of armed police and troops standing guards in most of the major cities and towns in there. And the trouble is it's very difficult to control the situation even with such tight control.
Well, Xiong, let's talk very specifically. This latest violence appears to have been sparked by anger over two deaths of two migrants in Guangdong province, which is actually far from the rioting. But can you distinguish this kind of ethnic tension from what goes on and is maybe more familiar to our listeners in Tibet?
Well, there are parallels to what's happening in Xinjiang and Tibet. That is, there is a local resentment to the central government policies and controls in their respective regions. For the Tibetans, it's more to do with religious freedom and cultural preservation. For the Uyghurs, apart from the cultural and ethnic issues, there's also the job opportunities too. We've seen the Chinese economy developing so fast, and the central government is also trying to develop the western part of the region to tap into the natural resources and to create wealth for that region as well.
And as, as growth in China begins to stall in the midst of the recession, we've already been warned that this could exacerbate ethnic tensions. It sounds like at the very least some of that is going on here. Xiong Chen is China editor for the BBC,
right,
joining us from London. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. An update on the definition of the word quitter. Palin through the eyes of some of her supporters in just a moment. But as the world says goodbye to Michael Jackson, we're asking you to weigh in. Who do you think is the best live performer of all time?
Hi, this is Mike from Wayne, New Jersey. I'm voting for one of my favorite groups, Earth, Wind & Fire.
Linda, New Jersey. Earth, Wind & Fire. A wonderful show. They are performers.
Don't shine a star, no matter who you are.
That's our demo. Earth, Wind, and Fire listeners, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Mark Garrison has the headlines.
Thank you, John. 12 minutes before the hour, on the second day of his visit to Moscow, President Obama stressed stopping the spread of nuclear weapons. He heads to the Vatican for his first visit there later this week to meet with Pope Benedict. This morning, the Pope called for a new world economic order, denouncing the greed he blames for the global economic meltdown. In the U.S., fans of Michael Jackson will gather at the Staples Center in Los Angeles for his public memorial there today. Police say they will arrest scalpers trying to sell tickets to the service. That's after eBay and Craigslist have pulled online sales postings. In the capital, ousted Honduran leader Manuel Zelaya meets with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton today. The U.S. hopes to resolve the military coup peacefully and restore Zelaya to office. The Running of the Bulls is underway in Pamplona, one of Spain's most famous events, kicking off today. And here's the sound of that event. They're singing, asking for the patron saint of Pamplona, Fermin, to protect them. It's not the wisest thing to do. Well, the city, not the like that. So they're asking for his help in doing something that's not the wisest move to make.
Why would he help them at this
skewing? I don't know. I feel like he's probably got better things to do among other sainthood duties. But
and again, maybe not.
It doesn't stop them from asking.
Wake her up and run over by a bull.
Thanks, Mark. Guys.
Whatever made you want to change your mind? Sarah, Sarah, so easy to look at, so hard to define.
Man, Dylan is a fast songwriter.
Yeah, he
came up with that like in one weekend.
The man knows his market. I'll tell you what, knows how to get to the top of the pops right away. Well, the reason behind Governor Sarah Palin's resignation in Alaska last Friday remains a mystery for most of us. Why indeed did you change your mind, Sarah? Was it for family, for money, for a slot on Fox News as a commentator, presidential aspirations? Well, there are plenty of people criticizing Sarah Palin, but right now we're going to check in with some of her supporters. Marjorie Dannenfelser is the president of the Susan B. Anthony List, which is a political action committee, and co-founder of Team Sarah, as in Sarah Palin. Jimmy Bice writes the blog thesundriesshack.com. They're both Sarah Palin supporters. Marjorie, I want to start with you. On your blog, you talk to thousands of Sarah Palin supporters all over the country, just like yourself. What are the reactions you're seeing from these people on her resignation so far?
Well, since Friday, we've had a surge of support and new members, a lot of new activity where it's been quiet for a while. The support there is just palpable, and the reaction to a lot of the punditry has been forceful.
Can I ask, though, support for what? Because she has not said what she's going to do.
Support for her decision. Frankly, this group is such an organic movement. Support for her as a human being and the decisions that she has made and whatever she decides to do in the future. They're just it's hard to understand if you have not been following her day-to-day life how loyal they are to her and her family and to her career. They just believe in her in a way that defies all sort of inside the Beltway, inside Manhattan, inside L.A. Conventional wisdom, because it is indeed conventional. She is not a conventional candidate. She's got a charisma that is really surpass that of anyone, especially women in politics, for quite some time.
Jimmy Bice, do you have any insight into her reasons for resigning?
I don't know that it takes a whole lot of insight. All you have to really do is kind of pay attention to what she said, and she's going to lay her reasons out pretty plainly. She had a lot of ethics complaints that were costing her in her personally and her state quite a bit of money, and she felt that it was taken away from her ability to govern Alaska.
But she's not the first politician to confront those kinds of things. And most people, I know you've heard this criticism, but most people hang in till the end of their term. She's not the first governor to face ethics complaints.
Oh, sure, not at all. But I would say that you'd have to go a long way to find someone that handled, I think we're up to, 15 or 18 complaints since November. Her lieutenant governor came out and said, either over the weekend or yesterday, that it was costing the state actually $2 million just apart from her. And that's one of the reasons. And the other reason she gave is the toll on her family. And you have to really kind of give it a second thought when you're not the target, but when your family, when your children start to become the target of these attacks.
Right, but Jimmy and Marjorie, there's a word for that. It's called quitting. If it's too tough, you quit.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what she did,
well,
right?
Let me ask this. What part of Sarah Palin's biography to this point has actually said quitter? Because I don't see it.
The fact that she gave up her governorship.
Let's also consider when she became governor in 2006, which we helped elect her, so we were involved in this. She did not buy into this. She did not buy into being daily attacked, having her, you know, Down syndrome kid a target of attack. She didn't buy into spending her own time and the Alaska's time and Alaska's money every single day, not just receiving attacks from, you know, these ethics complaints that have all been dismissed, by the way, but attacks from the blogosphere, the media, the Republican establishment, the feminist movement, the Democratic establishment. I mean, we can't pretend that this is a scale equal to anything that we've seen before.
All right.
This is over the top and not what she bought into.
All right, Margaret.
She quit the oil commission, right? Didn't she? She didn't finish college?
She finished college.
Did she finish college?
She finished college. She went to several different colleges.
She went to a bunch of different colleges,
yeah.
Right.
Well,
is that a problem?
I'm just trying to get the issue of quitting, you know, that
well,
whole
you like
quitting.
That issue because it's something that is a, you know, it's a drumbeat that's out there. But it is very hard to imagine the life that she is leading unless you're following it all the time. And I think it's a very sacrificial and brave thing that she has done. She's passed this responsibility to someone who can actually do the job in the way that she thinks it needs to be done because her job has been made impossible.
Jimmy Bice, in reaction to this, even a lot of Sarah Palin's erstwhile supporters have criticized her timing, her speech, whether or not this enables her to have a viable political future. You're surrounded by Sarah Palin supporters. Have you seen any unease or discomfort or dissension in the ranks of strong Sarah Palin supporters about the way she did this, even if they support her in general?
There's some people quite a few people, I would say, even among supporters who I think tend to buy into kind of the general conventional wisdom that, well, this is no way to go. This is no way to get ahead in public office. I would say that that Sarah Palin has been successful by doing the things that the conventional wisdom says not to do. She's never taken a conventional approach to success in her personal life or her professional life. Whatever she decides to do, the thing that you can pretty much bet on is that she's going to do it from an angle and an approach that nobody's going to suggest to her now. She's going to get there her own way. She's going to get there with her counsel and the counsel of her family and some trusted friends. And what she's not going to do is listen to the conventional wisdom. It's worked for her so far. I don't see any reason to think that it won't work for her again.
Marjorie Dannenfelser, co-founder of Team Sarah, very quickly, is she going to run for president?
I don't know, and I don't believe she knows, but she has certainly earned the right to do it if she chooses to.
You think she can win?
Yeah, I think if she decides that she is going to run, she absolutely could win.
Marjorie Dannenfelser is co-founder of Team Sarah, as in Sarah Palin. It's actually a group that raises money for Sarah Palin, and Sarah Palin is saying that she's going to need money to pay her legal bills, $500,000 worth. And Jimmy Bice is a conservative blogger who writes The Sundry Shack. Thanks to both of you.
A better cause would be just to give the money to me, I think.
$500,000.
Sure. I mean, I could use it, yeah. Michael Jackson's memorial service is being held this morning in Los Angeles. Stevie Wonder, Mariah Carey, Usher will all be there. Some may perform. And we're wondering, who do you think is the best live performer of all time?
The best live band, at least I've ever seen, would have to be Daft Punk, because their show is as much for your eyes as it is for your ears.
Well, we can help your ears out at least. Much better demo there. Tell us the best performer you've ever seen or want to see at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Here's your takeaway.
I would definitely say that he's not being received as a rock star. He's being received respectfully, but certainly not like the kind of celebrity coverage that we've seen in other places. Certainly nothing like, for example, what we saw in Germany last year.
Rock star Barack Obama, not quite in Moscow. That's Clifford Levy, New York Times Moscow bureau chief. President Obama gave a speech there today. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Todd Zwillick.
This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Message to Dmitry Medvedev. President calling.
Hello? Hello, Dmitry. Listen, I can't hear too well. Do you suppose you could turn the music down just a little? Oh, that's much better.
Okay, let's try it again. Dmitry, Obama calling.
Let me be clear. America wants a strong, peaceful, and prosperous Russia. This belief is rooted in our respect for the Russian people and a shared history between our nations that goes beyond competition.
Long after the Cold War chills and the days of Dr. Strangelove, President Barack Obama speaks to students in Moscow and Dmitry Medvedev. Post-cold warmth. If there's any, we'll find it on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Tuesday, July 7th. I'm John Huckenberry. A look at the dialogue in Moscow on, of all things, economics. Also, nukes in the Obama era, some new numbers, and the final resting place for the king of pop. Who decides? Beleaguered advertisers finding a place for their messages in a recession-weary world. Todd Zwillick is in the co-host seat this morning. Do you have any sponsors, Todd?
Like I told you before, Disco Todd does not advertise.
Those stories coming up. First, these headlines. In the headlines, fans are swarming the Staples Center in Los Angeles ahead of Michael Jackson's memorial there in just a few hours. Police say they will arrest scalpers trying to sell tickets to the service. On the second day of his visit to Moscow, President Obama urged the Russian people to join the U.S. in burying the mistrusts of the Cold War, saying the days of big power politics, when countries could be treated as chess pieces, are over. But joining us now from the BBC in London is Rob Watson, BBC defense correspondent. The president in his speech had an interesting caveat to suggest that his anti-missile system that has been proposed for Europe, he said it was going to be used only in case of a missile attack by Iran. And it seems, Rob, that he at least potentially allowed for the possibility of dismantling the project altogether. What's your take?
Well, he certainly hasn't given the game away. I think that was, he's not saying that missile defense is up for grabs, but he's certainly leaving some options open.
It's the BBC's Rob Watson. We're going to talk more about that speech in Moscow in just a moment. Back in the headlines, in the U.S. on the Hill today, Al Franken is going to be sworn in officially as Minnesota's junior senator. He's going to place his right hand on a Bible from the family of the late Minnesota Senator Paul Wellstone. Todd?
Well, staying in Washington, John, ousted Honduran leader Miguel Zelaya meets with Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton today. The U.S. hopes to resolve the military coup in Honduras peacefully and restore Zelaya to power in office. Also, the small town of Gaffney, South Carolina, is breathing a little easier now that the man believed to be behind 5 murders in 6 days is dead. He was shot dead during a burglary attempt. Law enforcement say the man's gun matches the gun used in those 5 murders.
It's a bizarre story. In sports, another hot day as the Tour de France enters its fourth stage. Lance Armstrong heads into the stage in third place. World markets mostly flat yesterday and this morning. The Dow opens this hour at 83.25. The NASDAQ begins at 17.87. Futures trading suggest a flat opening. Michael Jackson has been called the king of pop. Part of that is due to his live performances. We're asking you all morning long, who's the best live performer you ever saw? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Huckenberry here with Todd Zwillick. President Barack Obama gave a speech to the Progressive New Economic School in Moscow earlier this morning.
What kind of future is Russia going to have? What kind of future are Russia and America going to have together? What world order will replace the Cold War? Those questions still don't have clear answers.
And Barack Obama is certainly not the first American president to ask those kinds of post-Cold War questions. Joining me to talk about the whole opportunity of what the speech in Moscow represents and this trip represents for U.S.-Russian relations is Mark Kramer, director of the Cold War Studies Project at Harvard University, also a senior fellow of Harvard's Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies. Still with us, of course, Rob Watson, BBC's defense and security correspondent. Rob, is there anything different about Barack Obama's post-Cold War overtures to a new era of Russian-American relations than, say, presidents in the past, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton?
Well, my instant judgment would be not entirely that it's more of a continuation rather than a break, but of course what does, if you like, add to the impact of it is the man who's making it and the fact that he's young, the fact that he's the first African-American president. So I think a continuation rather than some radical break in the message sent by others. I mean, of course, he did emphasize this idea that the United States wants a strong, peaceful and prosperous Russia, which I think was exactly what the Russians want to hear.
And let's get to the numbers. The agreement that was announced in advance of the speech, I believe, suggests that, and maybe it's not an official announcement, but we're getting some hints that the numbers on reductions of nuclear forces on both sides, Russian and American, are actually on track to continue the original start targets. And what are those numbers at this point, and where do you think we will be a year from now?
Good question. Well, the current numbers are around about 2,200, and the aim is, what they've agreed to, is to somehow get the number of strategic warheads, that is, warheads which are actually on delivery vehicles, ready to go, down from this 2,200 to somewhere between 1,500 and 1,675.
And when might they be able to do that?
Well, the idea is, because the START treaty expires at the end of December, that the agreement on all the figures and the fine print would have to come by the end of the year.
So, Mark Kramer, what do you think the opportunity is here for Barack Obama then?
Well, the first thing I would say is it's somewhat disappointing that here now, 18 years after the Soviet Union collapsed, that the relationship with Russia is still so focused heavily on strategic arms control. That was really an issue of the Cold War era with the Soviet Union. And there were hopes, including with me in 1992, that the relationship with Russia would be different, that it would move on to other issues. And for a while it did seem that way, but now because the two sides disagree so strongly on other key issues, the inclusion of Georgia and Ukraine in NATO, the status of Iran, or how to deal with Iran, the missile defense systems that you mentioned earlier, although there's nothing to dismantle yet, there's nothing there. But they disagree so strongly on that they have to come back to this issue. There's still a lot to be negotiated. There was an informal agreement reached in 2002 between Bush and Putin, but that and there's some framework that can be built on there as well. But there's still a lot to be negotiated here. And frankly, again, as I say, it's somewhat disconcerting that the relationship is so heavily focused on this.
You know, let's talk about that anti-missile program. This is what Barack Obama said, talking about the missile plan that was originally proposed by George W. Bush, an anti-missile system that we based in Europe. The Russians very much against it. Here's Barack Obama's reference to it.
I want to work together with Russia on a missile defense architecture that makes us all safer. But if the threat from Iran's nuclear and ballistic missile programs is eliminated, the driving force for missile defense in Europe will be eliminated, and that is in our mutual interests.
Rob Watson, is that going to work, hanging a "this is for Iran" sign around a missile defense system in Europe? I mean, is that a little naive?
Well, I'm not sure that I'd use the word naive, but it was certainly the line of approach tried by the Bush administration, and boy, did I watch them trying at all sorts of different forums, whether it was at NATO or whenever there was an opportunity, and essentially that the Bush line was always that, look, this is ridiculous saying that this missile system is a threat to Russia, because the system would just be overwhelmed by any Russian attack. This couldn't possibly be seen as a threat. But that that line of argument didn't work with Moscow then, and I'm not sure that it's really going to have cut much ice now.
Well, Mark Kramer, you're senior fellow of, let us remind people, you're senior fellow of Harvard Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies, and your disappointment that we're treading over the old ground of strategic disarmament, this is sort of being cast as the White House, by the White House, as a way to keep dangerous nuclear weapons, WMDs, out of the hands of rogue states and terrorists. Is that just new packaging?
Yeah, that's a different issue.
Uh-huh.
That's an important issue, and the Clinton administration, Bush 1 administration started it, and then the Clinton administration continued very valuable efforts that did help Russia to secure nuclear materials.
But I'm a little bit confused though. Strategic arms reduction is a separate thing from keeping nukes out of the hands of Al-Qaeda.
Correct.
So it's not going to help keep them away from Al-Qaeda or people
no,
in Pakistan.
No, strategic arms control was an issue that the Soviet Union and the United States dealt with in the 1970s and 1980s because
right.
the relationship didn't have much more than that. Nowadays, the relationship in principle should have more than that. So strategic arms control still has some importance, but it shouldn't be the primary issue in the relationship.
It is,
but it shouldn't be.
Wasn't it just low-hanging fruit for this trip, maybe?
Yes, exactly, because they're not going to reach agreement on this trip on the other issue. So it was something they could reach an agreement in principle on this particular issue.
Well, this, of course, is how it goes. You agree on things that you already agree on, call them breakthrough agreements, and then hope you can forge ahead. I mean, that
correct.
Makes...
Although there was one important agreement here, which is the Russia's decision to allow the United States to use air flights over Russia to resupply and support forces in Afghanistan. That actually is an important agreement.
Well, let's focus on that for just a moment. I mean, on the one hand, that's cooperation in Obama's war in Afghanistan, which has a certain irony to it since the Russians were sent packing from Afghanistan a generation ago. Yet, it's also possibly the precursor to some sort of cooperative arrangement that could have influence in South Asia, Afghanistan, Iran, and Pakistan. Mark, do you think that's possible here?
Yes. I mean, generally, the Russians share the U.S. interest in countering the Taliban. So on this particular issue, there's a shared interest. Where there isn't in South Asia is in dealing with Iran. The Russians claim to want to prevent Iran from gaining nuclear weapons, but unfortunately, their behavior really hasn't been conducive to that.
Well, Rob Watson, would it be a sign that the U.S.-Russian relationship is moving into a fundamentally new territory post-Cold War? If there was actual agreement on, besides overflights, but some sort of cooperative arrangement to oppose Iran, to deal with Pakistan?
Absolutely. I mean, as Mark was saying, I think there's no doubt that the United States shares the United States and Russia share a common antipathy towards the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. But, of course, it's interesting to see when it comes to other states, particularly one thinks of Iran and, I guess, to a lesser extent, North Korea. And absolutely, sure, if you see that Russia starts to play a responsible game when it comes to proliferators amongst countries that it considers friends, if it takes a more responsible stance, then perhaps maybe then one could say, yes, we have a different world. But, I think we're a long way from that. I mean, if you look at the continuing disagreements over Russia and over Georgia and Ukraine, and this general idea that in Russia that, actually we do still believe in a sphere of influence and we do still feel as though we should have a big say in what happens in former Soviet Union.
That's perhaps the biggest obstacles there in the relationship are Putin and Medvedev themselves. The test of this new relationship now going on in Moscow. Barack Obama visiting there. Mark Kramer, director of the Cold War Studies Project at Harvard University, also a senior fellow at Harvard's Davis Center. And Rob Watson, of course, a friend of The Takeaway and BBC defense and security correspondent. Thanks to you both. Coming up, some more thoughts on Michael Jackson, where the world is preparing to say goodbye to him in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And we're asking the question. What is the question? Come on.
Well,
Todd.
But the question is,
what is the question?
Who is the greatest live performer
you're
of all time?
Obviously not.
Jeez. The one who stopped talking and looked at me. Who is the greatest live performer of all time? Is there anyone that can take Michael Jackson's place? It might be Bruce Springsteen. It might be Bill Clinton.
We've been getting suggestions all morning long. 877-8 my take or my take at the takeaway.org.
Do not vote for
John.
What about
Mark Garrison? Mark Garrison, maybe.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. Todd Zwillick here with John Hockenberry. Thousands of people will attend Michael Jackson's memorial service in Los Angeles today. A couple tens of thousands in the Staples Center, probably tens of thousands of more around the perimeter. Police lines already forming. Roads closed down at 6 a.m. to get people to and from the site without major traffic disruptions. A huge, huge event on the West Coast for the memorial of the King of Pop. Well, lots of stars will be at Michael Jackson's memorial in L.A. today. They include Stevie Wonder, Mariah Carey, and Usher. Some of them may perform. It made us wonder, who do you think is the best live performer of all time? It could be Michael Jackson, but if not, who can inherit that throne?
Second to Michael Jackson, I would have to say the Queen of Pop might be Madonna.
Material Girl, tell us the best performer you've ever seen or want to see. Doesn't have to be a musician. Some people think it's Bill Clinton. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Details are still murky, but it's being widely reported, of course, that Michael Jackson will be buried this morning at 10 a.m. Pacific time in Los Angeles at the famous Forest Lawn Cemetery, not as he had apparently wished at his Neverland Ranch. Well, joining us now to talk about the ethics of burial and whether we should defer to the dead when it comes to disposing of their mortal remains is Randy Cohen. He's the ethicist columnist for the New York Times and author of the Moral of the Story blog. Randy.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
So, Randy, this notion that we do everything possible to honor the wishes of the dead out of respect for them, as we always say. Well, it's what they would have wanted. That's what we always say when we try to honor the wishes of the dead. That might not be happening here.
And rightly so, I think. Although the first obstacle is just one of permits. If he wished to be buried at the ranch, there's a problem with permits that might take a while to sort out. But there were reports that many family members objected to this idea. So whose wishes do you adhere to? And I think you certainly consider the desires of the dead, but you don't defer to them. I think they're beyond caring what happens to them.
They're beyond caring what happens to them, and so burials and disposition of the dead is really for the living, in your view.
Death is for the living, yes. That the physical presence of the dead is very, very meaningful for the living. Simply to grasp the idea that death has occurred is a very challenging task. I think that's one reason Lincoln's body was taken by train through 180 cities from Washington to Springfield and removed at stop after stop so mourning Americans could see it for themselves. It's why soldiers are determined to restore the remains of their fallen comrades, even when it took place when death occurred years and years ago, as in Vietnam now, that life seems somehow suspended unless we're in the presence of the dead.
So why this attachment, do you think? We always say it's what grandma would have wanted. We have to do this because it's what they would have wanted. Sometimes that's associated with burial. Of course, it's probably also associated with a lot of other things in our lives that we pressure ourselves and others to do in the name of the dead.
Sure. Should you remarry, or should you not remarry? You're guided by your connection to someone you really loved and whose opinion you really care about.
Well, Randy, I mean, speaking of people's opinions who I care about, I have stipulated in my will that I am to be buried in a terrarium in your living room. So
there you go. I'm happy to have you. You know, I've cleared the spot for it. I stipulated in my will that I'm to be put out in a hefty bag on recycling day. That I'm not a religious guy, but I do respect the recycling laws. But I think we're both wrong, John. I think it doesn't so much matter what we want. We're gone. We don't get a vote in it. I think our bodies will be important to those left behind, and if we care about them, they get to decide.
So, Randy, what do you see in the different burial traditions? You talked about in your blog a little bit different traditions ranging from Jewish traditions of simple coffins with holes drilled in them for the Orthodox to Zoroastrians who invite vultures to come and consume the body. What do you make of the different popular traditions in treatment of dead and what they say about people?
Well, one of the interesting things about it is that every religion has rules for what we do with the dead, but they're often contradictory. Some religions allow embalming. Islam bars it. Some favor cremation. Some forbid it. And that we often look to religion to solve these kind of profound questions. But here we see
not exclusively. I mean, there may be some vultures at the Michael Jackson affair.
You keep your cracks about the William Morris Agency to yourself, sir. When we look to religion, we're hoping that it will refer to profound, fundamental moral principles that can help us guide our actions. But you don't get that with bodies. Here, each contradicts the other. So I'm not sure how useful that is for people. And you know, the Parsi are facing there's a big vulture shortage in India. The Parsi are Zoroastrians that live in India, and there are about 400,000 of them. And they believe the physical presence of death, whether you bury a body or burn it, taints the purity of the mortal world, and so they leave it to vultures to consume it. But because India is expanding so rapidly, vulture habitats are threatened, and the Parsi don't have enough vultures now.
All right, so human death is a pressure on the vulture community as well.
I'm just wondering if the New York Times is reporting this morning that the body vetoes the spirit. I mean, that's what you've taken that position now twice. Is that what the Times is going with now?
Oh, well, I wish the Times consulted me on its positions. I speak only for myself, not for the paper. But it's true, I take a resolutely secular approach to ethics in the column. The spirit gets very little claims in my work, yes.
All right, Randy, just to bring it back to Michael Jackson real quick before we go, a man with so many tens of hundreds of millions of fans is dead, and we're talking about disposition of remains. Is there any balance between wishes of the family versus wishes of the performer versus wishes of the world at large who cared so much about him?
Yeah, everybody has a claim here, and that's one of the ways in which a cemetery so often serves everybody's needs. I mean, the great cemeteries of the world, by which I mean the ones where all the great are buried, you know, Highgate Cemetery near London, where Karl Marx is buried, or our own Greenwood Cemetery in Brooklyn, which has, you know, Boss Tweed and Margaret Sanger. People, both family members and just people that are moved by the great can visit these places and commune with the dead, and that seems a genuinely meaningful human experience that can reconcile all the conflicting desires.
Randy Cohen, the ethicist from the New York Times Magazine and author of The Moral of the Story blog. We're talking about Michael Jackson and the death of Michael Jackson. Randy, thanks for joining us.
And making faces and making friends like you. And when we grow up, do you think we'll see that I'm still like you and you're still like me?
Mark Garrison is here with the headlines.
Thank you, Todd. 29 minutes after the hour, President Obama is on day two of his Russia trip. Earlier today, he met with Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. President Obama struck a hopeful note after that talk.
We think there's an excellent opportunity to put U.S.-Russian relations on a much stronger footing.
Looking ahead, President Obama will also visit Pope Benedict at the Vatican later this week. Minnesota will finally get its second senator today. Al Franken will be sworn in this afternoon. Ousted Honduran leader Manuel Zelaya is taking his case to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. The two plan to meet today in Washington. The U.S. supports returning him to power. John and Todd.
Thanks, Mark.
The
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
So in about 3.5 hours, Michael Jackson's memorial service will begin at the Staples Center in Los Angeles. We'll be live streaming that memorial service on thetakeaway.org, our website, so tune in for that. And even though his final resting place is Los Angeles, Aaron Flournoy, waiter at Bennigan's in the hometown of Michael Jackson, Gary, Indiana, what are you going to be doing when the memorial ceremony gets started in Los Angeles?
See, I'm gonna be at work. We having a little memorial ceremony up here for him too at the Bennigan's Inn at the Diamond Center. So we're gonna be partying up here too.
And so you got some big screens, and
yes, we do. We have about 10 of them.
And any sort of specials for people who come in?
Actually, not right now. We're gonna have that for him on the July 10th. We throw him a big party, and it's gonna be free for everybody, for the kids and adults. So that's gonna be on July 10th. But for right now, y'all could come in and come chill with us.
What do you think the people of Gary are saying goodbye to today?
Michael Jackson himself. That's who they're saying goodbye to. Michael Jackson for the things he did for Gary and for the talent that he brought to Gary.
So none of the complex, weird stories of celebrity. It's just the boy grew up here, incredible talent, changed the world. That's what you're saying goodbye to.
That's exactly what we're saying goodbye to. Forget what everybody else is trying to talk about. We remember Michael Jackson as the man and the performer he is. That's what we remember.
What's the tune you most want to hear? And it'll be covered, of course, at the memorial service, because there's going to be some concerts.
Michael Jackson, one of his last hits, Butterflies.
Butterflies. All right. That's one I haven't heard this heard suggested this morning. Aaron Flournoy, stay with us, okay? Waiter at Bennigan's in Gary, Indiana. Josh Rogerson, radio producer and Takeaway correspondent here at the Staples Center in Los Angeles. Are things getting a little more crowded down there, Josh?
Yeah, I'm just across from the Staples Center on Olympic Boulevard, standing on a corner with about, I'd say, 150 people, some of which have wristbands and some do not, including Cassandra Anderson here from Long Beach, who I'm going to hand the phone to right now.
So, Cassandra, you're pretty lucky.
I am lucky. Well, I'm lucky enough to be here today to celebrate the life of Michael Jackson and the tremendous things he did to bring different people together and break a million bajillion boundaries. But I'm not lucky enough to get a wristband, but I'm still a very, very, very dedicated fan, and stay have been here since 12 o'clock at night, so.
All right, you're not lucky enough to get a wristband, right?
No, I did not get a wristband.
Now, they say that it's illegal to even try to purchase one. Have you been tempted?
Well, considering they're $1,500, no.
It's a $1,500 fine?
No, it's $1,500. People are selling them for $1,500.
Oh, so it's like way above your price there.
Yeah, I'm a full-time student, so that wouldn't work for me.
So are you a student in the Los Angeles area?
I am. Well, Long Beach. Yeah, I go to Long Beach State.
All right. Now, what song are you most hoping to hear covered at the memorial concert later today?
I'm sure that Man in the Mirror will be played, and I'm looking forward to seeing that. They haven't put the Jumbotron up, so I'm hoping that they do, so that all the people who weren't lucky enough to get in can still enjoy the memorial and feel his presence around us. So.
All right. Well, thank you, Cassandra. Hand the phone back to Josh there for a second.
Thank you.
Hey, Josh.
All right.
Is she pretty typical of the young students who are fans? And are there any sort of older generation maybe who know the Jackson 5 like I do?
Yes, there's been all kinds of people. A gentleman I spoke to earlier came all the way from London, got time off from work, and he actually went to the Victory Tour back in the 80s.
Wow.
And as did I. We sort of reminisced about that. That was sort of my introduction to Michael Jackson as well. So there's all kinds of different fans here today. A lot of people are just sort of waiting across the street so that they can gain access to the venue. They're not letting people even with wristbands in just yet.
Hey, Josh, Todd Zwillick here. I have to ask, any red leather jackets with zippers, gloves, short pants?
No red leather jackets, but there is a gentleman with spats on and a red hat. He actually did a moonwalk across Olympic Boulevard from the Staples Center after being rejected by all the officers to not pass through.
All important fashion question, Aaron Florno. I think I heard you laughing there in the background. Are there going to be are there going to be some costumes at the Bennigan's and Gary?
Man, there's been so many people coming up here with their little Michael Jackson costumes, little gloves and everything. It's been wild up here. It's been wild.
Now, if you could put the money together and get out there and buy a wristband, Aaron, how much would you pay?
How much would I pay for a Michael Jackson? It's priceless.
Yeah.
It's priceless. That's exactly what I'd say. It's priceless.
All right, Josh, one more fan there, and then we got to go?
Sure. Let me see if I can find someone with a wristband. Let's see. Okay, I did find someone. Okay, they wanted to say hello. Introduce yourself.
Hi.
Hi there. You're going to be inside the Staples Center?
Yes, I'm excited. I've been there since like 1 o'clock, so I'm ready.
What's your name, and what song do you want to hear?
Oh, my name is Michelle, and I want to hear Thriller.
Thriller.
we've been playing everything out here, and I haven't heard the Thriller song.
All right, well, Josh Rogerson and Michelle and Cassandra, thanks so much out there in Los Angeles. And Aaron, Aaron Flournoy, waiter at Bennigan's in Gary, Indiana, thanks so much for being a part of the program.
Appreciate it. Have fun.
The world says goodbye to Michael Jackson in Los Angeles in about 3.5 hours. Never, never say goodbye. Mark Garrison has the headlines.
Thank you, John. It's coming up on 21 minutes before the hour. President Obama is on day two of his Russia visit. He spoke to college grads and summarized the big questions facing the U.S. and Russia.
What kind of future is Russia going to have? What kind of future are Russia and America going to have together? What world order will replace the Cold War? Those questions still don't have clear answers.
Obama goes next to a G8 meeting in Italy. He'll also meet with Pope Benedict at the Vatican later on in the week. Alaska Governor Sarah Palin is back in the public eye today after her surprise resignation last week. She'll make her first public appearance since the Friday announcement at a bill signing coming later today. The South Carolina Republican Party has voted to censure Governor Mark Sanford after he left the state last month on a secret trip to meet his Argentine mistress. Governor Sanford says he still does not plan to step down. Over to the Middle East, reports of a suspected U.S. drone attack on a Taliban training camp. At least a dozen militants are dead, and many top al-Qaeda leaders are believed to be in the area. Finally today, the World Series of Poker is underway in Vegas, but hundreds of players are shut out because it's too full. Some 6,400 are in the game. The winner takes home more than $8.5 million. It costs 10 grand to get in. The total pot, by the way, is $61 million. So a lot to be won, and other people will win as well.
Don't have the 10 grand, though, Mark?
Not to spare.
And you don't feel very lucky?
I can feel lucky, but I don't have extra money.
Will
you stake me? If you'll stake me, I'll do it.
Thanks, Mark.
You've got to tell.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. President Obama is heading to Italy tomorrow for the opening of the G8. Well, and later this week, he's going to meet personally with Pope Benedict. Ahead of that meeting, the Pope has released a new document called Charity in Truth. It calls for a new financial world order to replace what he describes as the profit at all costs mentality of our globalized economy. Joining us now is David Willey, BBC Rome correspondent. David, His Holiness has some thoughts on the world economic crisis. Who's to blame?
Well, being the Pope, basically it's sin. That's the message of the encyclical. He says there's been too much greed. And although this is a closely reasoned 140-page document trying to extract the essentials from it, it seems to me that what the Pope is saying is that human failings such as greed are distorting the world's economy. He says we ought to have a new world financial order, and he's also called for the establishment of what he calls a true world political authority. In other words, I think what he's talking about is a radical reform of the United Nations.
Of the United Nations?
Of the United Nations as well.
Interesting.
He says so in other words, this is a political and economic analysis of the world's woes, so the papal analysis of why there's been this economic meltdown.
The Pope's assessment of sin and greed, it sounds like, if I may, he's saying the money changers are still in the temple.
He's trying to bring old traditional Catholic teaching up to date for the year 2000. The popes of the last two centuries have issued a series of these encyclical letters. That's the highest form of papal teaching, dealing with social issues. One of the most famous ones was in the end of the 1890s, Pope Leo XIII, and he was dealing with basically how the Church deals with the problems of the new industrial age. Well, Pope Benedict is trying to bring up to date, I think, the Church's teaching on a lot of things. He touches on a huge number of subjects in this encyclical letter. He talks about development aid, migration, rights of trade unions, terrorism, sexual tourism, which he thinks is a very bad thing, population, the environment, and so on. So it's a very, very wide-ranging series of small essays, I suppose you would call it, on what the Catholic Church thinks about these subjects. And it's a very interesting panorama.
Does a modern pope, in advance of meeting the president of the United States, expect the president to be briefed, not only on a document like this, but to be able to talk about whether there'll be any implementation?
I think the Pope is looking forward very much to his first meeting with President Obama. The Pope takes, I think you could call it, if you're looking at it in conventional political terms, a slightly left-of-centre view on social and financial and industrial policies. So I think that he'll find actually quite a lot in common with President Obama, despite the much trumpeted opposition of President Obama to any reform in the legalizing of abortion in the United States, for example. Abortion is a tricky issue at the Vatican. The Pope doesn't like to talk about that. But I think that on the wider political and economic issues of the day, funnily enough, the Pope and Obama are going to find a lot of common ground.
Well, maybe they can find some not only common ground, but good cheer in the Vatican, their first meeting, the President of the United States meeting Pope Benedict, who has a new economic encyclical out. He wants the president to read it. David Willey, BBC, thanks for joining us.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Perhaps on this day it is human nature to be tuning in about 3 hours from now to the memorial service for Michael Jackson, which gets underway in Los Angeles. It's a huge global story. There will be people besides folks in Los Angeles watching. And Jyotsna Singh is a reporter for the BBC in Delhi in India, where people will be tuning in India as well. Jyotsna, thanks for joining us.
Yes, indeed. In fact, you know, about 100 television stations here have been sort of promoting the special coverage of live coverage of this event, you know, for days. As you know, Michael Jackson, like everywhere else, has been huge in this country as well. He had, you know, huge influence on Bollywood singers and music directors. His death was received with a lot of grief. There were people, you know, there was an outpouring of grief when the news came. And for days, you know, every single twist and turn in his story has been followed here very keenly in the print media as well as television stations. So this evening, in the next couple of hours, there will be special coverage of that across all television channels, and you can expect millions of people watching that, following that. You know, I have had friends who've been calling in to check when exactly the ceremony starts.
It's certainly amazing to see the influence in world culture that Michael Jackson has had. Jyotsna Singh, thanks so much for being with us. BBC reporter in Delhi, India, where the Michael Jackson Memorial will be broadcast as well as throughout the world. Mark Garrison has some headlines.
Thank you, John. It's 12 minutes before the hour, or 11 minutes before the hour, rather. And we just heard from Mike about Michael Jackson's impact on India. They're watching on TV. That's how people of the police in Los Angeles want everyone to experience this that doesn't have a ticket, but they are worried that people will come. People will show up, so there's a big security presence there. Also, a zero-tolerance policy for Michael Jackson ticket scalpers for today's memorial. One fan, Ebony Butler, has a ticket, and she says she's fed up with people trying to profit from Jackson's death.
I'm not going to call them scum, but they weren't true Michael Jackson fans.
True scum, whatever you want to call them, online sales. They have hit five figures, some of these sales that are going on today. Let's go to Washington, where Al Franken will be sworn in as Minnesota's junior senator today. Also in Washington, ousted Honduran leader Manuel Zelaya meets with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton there. The U.S. has called for the military coup leaders to restore him to office in Honduras. John and Todd.
Thank you, Mark. Markets are open on Wall Street, moving downward, but it's early going yet. Public radio may be fond of having conversations about the future of journalism, but maybe the better question is, what's the future of advertising in a radically changing media market? There are a range of changes that advertisers are now dealing with, principally the failure of the auto industry, which supported the ad industry for a generation. Here to talk about some of the more subtle changes is our friend Cindy Gallup. She's been an advertising consultant and former chairman of the ad agency BBH. Cindy, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, there are all kinds of bemoaning the end of journalism, but in many ways, changes in advertising are possibly even more significant and more likely to affect more people. First of all, how are advertisers dealing with technological changes like TiVo, the proliferation of broadband on cell phones, that sort of thing?
Not very well, in that the advertising industry is riddled with fear and insecurity at the moment in the wake of both the explosion of all these technological advances and a great deal of nervousness and concern about exactly how they deal with them.
And it seems like there's this weird incestuous relationship between the content and the advertising, in the sense that the script writers are obsessed with getting ratings, and so they want to get the highest possible rating with the kind of content they use. The advertisers want to get into the content and not be sort of in this commercial ghetto. There are all sorts of product placement issues that are blurring the line between the entertainment part and the advertising part.
Well, product placement is interesting, John, because actually it's just one aspect of a much more fundamental trend that I see happening, which is that advertisers these days are so nervous and insecure about themselves and what they're doing that they tend to come from a place where they feel that, and quite rightly, that an awful lot of people out there think advertising is bad. And they are dealing with that by excusing their very existence and trying almost to bypass the fundamental issue, which is how do you make advertising a good thing? Product placement is just one aspect of how they are trying to bypass and step away from that particular core question.
To keep
question.
From apologizing for themselves.
Absolutely.
Well, let's listen to this ad, sort of, in the NBC show 30 Rock.
These Verizon wireless phones are just so popular, I accidentally grabbed one belonging to an acquaintance.
Well, sure, because that Verizon wireless service is just unbeatable. I mean, if I saw a phone like that on TV, I would be like, where is my nearest retailer so I can get one? Can we have our money now?
All right, now they're joking, but is Verizon getting invoiced for that amount of mention on 30 Rock?
Well, I think it's highly likely that Verizon will have struck some sort of deal.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But it's funny, they're apologizing for it. But in fact, that raises the profile of the product itself in the way that they keep joking about it.
It does indeed. And actually, 30 Rock is interesting because it's an example of the more successful approach to product placement, in that the very nature of the humor and the irony inherent in the series itself allows the producers to integrate commercial brands in a way that many other shows find a lot more difficult.
It seems to me that the whole approach and the tone is a way of saying, we know the deal, folks, right? They're selling products, we're selling programs. It's like we're all together in this. And all of a sudden the anxiety goes away and it's funnier.
In theory. But, John, I have to admit, I personally really take issue with that particular mindset. And I'm going to call up a quote from Mark Goldstein when he was CMO mm-hmm. at the advertising agency Fallon, who said a number of years ago, people hate advertising in general, but they love advertising in particular. And what that means is that if you ask the man in the street, what do you think of advertising? He'll go, oh, my God, I hate it. You know, gets in my way, commercial breaks, interrupts everything. But if you ask the man in the street, tell me some of your favorite ads, he'll go, I really love that Nike ad where they... So people hate advertising in general, but they love advertising in particular. Make it great, engaging advertising, and people feel it enhances their lives rather than the opposite.
Well, here's another strategy for deliberately blurring the line between a show and an ad. And tell me what you think of this. This is from the USA Network Psych, okay? And it starts out sounding like an actual episode and then becomes something quite different.
Think he's funny? That is a yes. Oh, dude, I'd look totally awesome driving this car. Sunroof down, hair blowing gently in the wind.
Don't move. Actually, he would look awesome driving his car.
I would.
Hop in there.
The new midsize Kia Optima gets 32 miles per gallon highway with a 5-star crash safety rating. Kia, the power to surprise. Watch all new episodes of Psych, Fridays at 10 on USA.
Now, who's the driver and who's the passenger here? Is Psych riding the Kia brand, or is Kia riding the Psych brand?
Well, I think most people would say it's Kia riding the Psych brand. And again, I would argue that that's a very obvious mode of product placement and branded entertainment, if you like. The best examples, to be frank, are fully integrated into the action in such a way that the action could literally not exist without them. And that's why some of the best examples historically have been accidental product placement. When Tom Cruise took Ray-Ban aviators to extraordinary worldwide sales in Top Gun, that wasn't because Ray-Ban did a fantastic deal. That was because Ray-Ban gave sunglasses to every Hollywood movie in the hope that one day they'd strike it big. And they did with a movie that integrated them fully into the storyline.
That's brilliant. Did they know which one was going to hit?
No, not at all. And they didn't know that with Wayfarers and Risky Business either.
That's another great example. So what products can we see cast in Hollywood movies of the future?
Well, the ideal, and this is actually what a lot of advertisers are trying to do, is to actually get right in at the very heart of the concepting process before the script has even been written and actually find a way to tap into the ideation of what the next movies are going to be. But again, it's absolutely a lottery. You have no idea ultimately what will make it or what won't. But the best thing you can possibly do is integrate your brand and product in a way that means, as I say, quite literally, the storyline could not play out without it.
Maybe that means there'll be a credit someday, where right after casting director, there's product integrator.
It could well be. And I have to tell you, anybody who manages to achieve that fantastically will be extraordinarily sought after and very, very rich.
And you may be the first. Cindy Gallup, I wouldn't put it past you, advertising consultant, former chairman of the ad agency BBH. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
All right, Michael Jackson is being honored at a memorial service today in Los Angeles. Reports coming out now that his body will be at the Staples Center for the memorial. He's known for being a great live performer, and we want to hear your thoughts. Who do you think is the best live performer of all time?
The greatest performance of all time that I have seen has been Carlos Santana. Absolutely blew me away.
That's Carlos Santana, but some of you are sticking with the original.
Magic Woman.
Tony Livonia, the greatest entertainer of all time, is Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson. Tell us your thoughts, 8778.
Not going to get any arguments about that today.
You're not going to get any arguments. No. Michael Jackson's memorial in Los Angeles. Crowds forming now around the perimeter and in the Staples Center. And reports coming out now again that Michael Jackson's body will be at the memorial, according to CNN. Tell us your thoughts, 8778. My take, mytake at thetakeaway.org. The best performer of all time. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. See ya.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.